Welcome to another Positively Deviant Emergency Medicine interview. Today I've got Rob Lefevre. Anyone who knows Rob is fully aware he's persistently living the dream. Now, Rob has got teaching hospital and community hospital street cred, and he manages patient complaints, peer review, behavioral health initiatives. He's got a family. He's generally managing a lot, as you can tell. Somehow in all this, he doles out practical wisdom and opportunities for change without judgment or shame. What I think is special about Rob in this role is how often he diffuses stress and defensiveness in others in the midst of evaluating the care they provide. Now, in today's interview, I'm still learning the nuances of recording high-quality sound, but I don't think you're going to need to have a high-quality audio engineer to hear Rob's energy and love of his job. It's evident, obviously, in the first few minutes of his interview. So enough intro. Let's hear from Rob. Okay, so thanks for being on this podcast or whatever it's going to be.
Well, thanks for
having me. But as we talked about at our recent trip to SAEM in beautiful, sunny Orlando, Florida, we thought that it was a good idea to try to share tips and techniques amongst the different staff docs in particular. And so my technique here is to try to talk to you about how you work through a shift or maybe even beyond a shift to try to let other people know, why are you so damn good? Like, how does Rob have it all put together, and how can I be more like Rob?
Oh boy, if that's what we're going for here, we're in trouble.
That's you've heard the rent is too damn high. This might be working title.
I like
how
that.
How is Rob so damn good? So damn good.
Right, exactly.
Well, okay, so as we wrestle with our mics here, I'm going to basically say, and I've got a sort of an open question and a closing question. Do you enjoy your work and why?
Oh, that's a great question. Boy, absolutely. I've been here, including residency now, for 16 years, and I love it. I love teaching. I love our patients. We've got a fantastic mix. I love the people here that we work with. Do I love my work? Absolutely. They will drag me out of here kicking and screaming.
All
right. One way or another. There is no doubt. I mean, I have it in my mind, and it's not going to be kicking and screaming. I'll be throwing stuff. I'll be tearing stuff off the wall.
Are you going to be in a box? Is that what you're trying to say? Are you going to beat the doms in what appears to be the RJ shot?
It might be, yeah, but I'll just tell you that if they do drag me out of here, I'm not going quietly.
All right.
Well,
I guess that's for you, Kurt, and everybody above him.
That's right.
You're on notice. So when you, on average, it sounds like, I'm going to ask you in general, do you feel when you leave a shift, do you feel drained, fulfilled, both, something else? Or like in general, do you kind of tap dance out the door? Do you feel like, oh man, I did a lot of good work? Or do you feel more like, man, the system is getting me down?
Boy, that's a good question. I think sometimes it's a little of both. I think for the most part, you know, there are shifts where it feels like everything just rolls and everything is smooth. And I walk out the door going, wow, that was fun. Got to do a lot of fun stuff. Got to meet a lot of people, and it felt good. And then there are other times when you just feel like you can't do anything and everything takes an extra step and nothing's smooth. And you have to do one more thing on everyone. And it's the exact opposite. So those are the shifts that you can't wait to get out of here. So I think,
right.
I think it can go either way.
Yeah. And do you think, so I'd like to get into the techniques that maybe you might have learned to try to maintain resilience during a shift. We all talk about eating or taking a little break, which I think we'll get into, but I kind of just start with like the first 30 minutes. And before we do that, I know you work both here teaching a lot with residents, so that might be a very different kind of day and startup compared to working here or in the community at when you're yourself and maybe with or without a scribe. And so, but I'm mostly interested, like, how do you get things going for the day?
Yeah. Well, so that's a great question. And I hope we do come back to eating and taking breaks and sleeping, because those are some of the pillars. But how do I get it going? Well, it starts with a big orange rock star. That's my
key to wellness right there. Should we just stop now?
That's exactly right. Well, you asked me how we get the day started, and that is almost always how I get the day started.
Right.
But otherwise, I think the day starts just like anyone else. You show up, you get ready, you get as ready for your shift as you can, and we'll get to the eating and sleeping stuff. But then you show up and you take your sign outs.
Yeah. Okay. And do you do any sort of like, other than maybe trying to get your Visera on and things like that, like try to talk to anybody, or do you mostly just like get your sign outs and go?
So the truth, it's funny because I think people do this different ways. I don't want to know what the department's like before I get here. Uh-huh. I don't want to know who I'm taking sign outs from, good or bad. I prefer not to think about it. And so I really do. I start my day about 1 minute before my shift starts. Okay. And that's part of how, there are some people that like to get here early and kind of ease into it. I'd rather come in hot and start running right away rather than thinking about the shift any extra, because I'm going to be doing it for the next 8.5 hours. So I don't feel like I want to do it anymore.
Yeah, I get it. So we've talked about the beginning of the shift. How about the ends? Like, how long is your normal, what I call like mop up, do you think, or on average? Or is it so variable you couldn't even say?
So I think it is variable. For the most part, I would say 30 minutes or less is a typical, but I've been here hours after a shift when things turned into a disaster, especially right at the end. But I would say my typical, I'm usually out of here within 30 minutes after a shift.
Okay. And do you think there are any critical things you'd want to get into that, like, you know, if you did X, you have more control over getting out on time? Because there's always the 10 minute priority.
Yeah. Messes it up. Right. So I think that, I mean, for me, the main thing is keeping up on documentation throughout the shift.
Okay.
And what I often do, especially if I don't have much energy, I sort of make the conscious choice to not document during the shift. And then I'll try to catch up the second half of the shift, or I'll sit down if I have a good block and really get some notes done.
Yeah.
But when that falls apart, the second half of the shift, I think those are the shifts that I'm here forever.
Yeah.
But I think usually for me, it's more of a conscious choice, and I realize I'm doing it. And sometimes I hate the earlier version of me that decided to do that, but it's usually a choice.
It's funny. I think there's something about either your energy, at least I'm speaking from my experience, that energy level of like, at some point you're like, that's the least of my worries. And it could be because of sick patients. But part of what I'm trying to make sure is it's not because I'm just not taking a break or eating wrong or letting something get to me that I shouldn't, or something that's sapping my energy that needlessly that I could convert back into, no, I can push through, get a few more notes done, just keep focused, keep on it.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's some of it for me is just an energy level. Cause if I'm doing a 4 evening in a row shift, it's much more likely to happen on that fourth shift than it is on the first shift. So I think there is some sort of stamina and fatigue factor, but I also think it feeds on itself. The more behind I get, the more disorganized I feel, and I think the more disorganized I become, so the less likely I am to take the bathroom break or grab something to eat or take a little break. So I think it's also a little bit of a downward spiral.
Yeah. Once you've a few things have pushed you over the edge, it's not hard to go all the way.
Yep.
What do you think causes you the most stress during a shift? Like something you can categorize into one thing, I guess, because there could be lots of things. But
I think for the most part, what stresses me out the most is systems things. I think it depends on the part of the ER we're working in. There are pod D shifts that, honestly, what stresses me out the most is knowing that there are 30 patients in the waiting room waiting to see me, and I'm sitting there doing nothing. That actually stresses me out more. Uh-huh. Kind of pod D quick track type shifts.
Yeah.
Than being overwhelmed. It's actually not being able to get the work done. So I think it depends a lot on what's going on that day. But we can talk about the things that stress me out. And I think keeping up with documentation is probably the number one thing that is the hardest for me to do and hardest to I know that I need to do it. I know that I should do it. And sometimes I'm not doing it.
Yeah. And it's one of my questions is typically like, what are any tasks you purposely stop doing when you get stressed out? Or, and I think a lot of people's answer is documentation. It sounds like you've already told me that. What would you agree?
Yeah, documentation and bathroom breaks.
Bathroom breaks.
I am amazed at how often, and I can't do this in the rest of my life. You put me in a car and tell me I can't go to the bathroom for the next 3 hours, and I will immediately need to take a, I have to.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm amazed at how many times I finish up my documentation for a shift, walk up to my office, grab my keys, and realize not only do I have to pee now, I haven't gone right. for the last 8 hours. So I, you know, so I think those are the things that I need to let go of.
Right. 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 Yeah. Right. Do you think that when you're teaching or other things, and maybe you don't have as many, I mean, it can be pretty overwhelming depending on the situation of patients. Like sometimes I'm trying to figure out how often I'm teaching versus not teaching in terms of, do I need to do a little bit less teaching on something? And is teaching really socializing or am I teaching
right.
In favor of not stopping my documentation? Like that's an element I've constantly struggled with.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think for me, the teaching is one of the most rewarding yeah. aspects. And I think one thing that I kind of along with the teaching that I do let go, especially if at the end of the shift, if we're all behind and no one's notes are done, the thing that also gets tossed is the feedback at the end of the shift. And I try to do that throughout the shift, but I think especially at the end of the shift when we're all tired and we're all behind and we know we're going to be here past our shift, that one-on-one feedback with the residents often gets left out, and that's too bad. That's one of the things that I think often gets lost in the shuffle.
I'm glad you brought that up because I as we talk about that mop up, I've tried to figure out how to, like, because if you just were to say, hey, you need to tell the next person about the patients you have, which in some areas is a lot of patients, and give feedback. There's usually one or two you have to like discharge or admit yourself, like somebody you have to talk on, or like there's one of those, you like, I'll take care of that before I go.
Sure.
Like that's often already 45 minutes of work, especially yeah. if you're trying to give meaningful feedback and not here's the card I did for you.
Yep.
And so I've tried to figure out like, what do I stop doing? Like, even though I feel like I could go see that new patient 15 minutes before the end of my shift, I'm trying to remember that the trade-off is like, I'm probably not giving the feedback that I could be. And I hate that balance, honestly, because I want to be the guy who can get somebody done right at the end and not make them wait 45 minutes for the next doc because I feel lazy.
Right.
But on the other hand, I shortchange how much time it takes to do the mop-up a lot of times. And yep. particularly, I think the rewarding, important things that help build people's career, which is like the feedback,
yep.
and, timely feedback.
And I, for better or for worse, and I don't know if this is a great system or not, but one thing I have sort of figured out about myself is at that point when I'm tired and I'm behind, I don't give great feedback. And so what I've tried to do is I've really tried to build that into the shift during the shift, real time, because I think when I'm already there an hour after the shift, and everyone, even if someone says, "Hey, do you have any feedback?" I think, I don't know, what did we see today? Let's, right. yeah, you seem to have pretty good flow, and whatever it is. But at that point, it's that really does get pushed to the side, and it's something that I want to do. So for me, it works better to give it during the shift, real time, to say, "Hey, it, you know, you're doing a good job of getting people out of here once they're ready." So,
so in our system with the cars, would you say you try to give the real time feedback during that, like right after that code or right after that encounter that you wanted to, like maybe if you approached it differently, kind of thing? But then at the end, you might scribble that onto a card.
Yep,
you're not having a new session about that.
That's, I think sometimes I do, and sometimes it's nice to be able to wrap it up at the end of a shift. But I also realize that that's sort of the most vulnerable time to get lost. And during the shift, I feel like I have time and I can do it.
Yeah.
And I'm I would rather give that feedback and have those conversations during the shift and sort of push off my documentation. But having those conversations at the end of the shift, it is just when I'm not at my best as far as providing feedback and really taking the time to do a good job at it before I'm trying to go home.
That makes sense to me. And I think that's part of teaching a lot of times. It's like you can easily have the clinical, like, which drug to use discussion, and then also try to incorporate more of the, and those which drug to use discussions usually have to happen before you give the drug, for example. So it sort of forces you to have those during the shift a lot of the time.
Right.
But the, how did you handle that nurse interaction conversation, or how did, do you, can you reflect? I probably need to be less afraid of stopping somebody who's really trying to see more patients and saying, can we just talk about that interaction you just had? And like, is there a way that you could, and reflect on it? Like, did it feel good to you?
Right.
Like, 'cause I feel like I want to do more of that and not wait till the end of the shift, 'cause it's even more timely.
Yep. Well, and it is, it's hard. And it's hard for me to remember those details at the end of the shift. And, you know, so for instance, if you want to talk to people about flow, I feel like it's easier during the shift to say, okay, so right now let's run your board.
Yeah.
You've got these five patients. That person, everything's back. So what are we waiting for? That should kind of be the first priority. Or even just say, hey, what are the next five things you're going to do? What's on your
list? Let's talk about that, because that's exactly my next question. It's sort of like a little bit of how do you handle changes in the distribution of your patients across the, are they new patients? Are they all waiting for beds? Are they a mix of somewhere in the middle? So like what, when you teach, or what do you practice yourself around, which I'm hoping is the same, is trying to, like, what's your workflow for, hey, I'm in the middle. It's not like I just got a bunch of new patients, but I have a few waiting for things. I've got a few new waiting on somebody else for something else. Like, how do you approach that moment? Like, if you run your board with yourself?
Or- yeah, when I run the board with my, I have an old, I've said this so many times that even annoys me a little bit, but I try to keep all the plates spinning.
Yeah.
So I it's the patient that everything's back on, and they're waiting for me. That's the, I'm the thing that's stopping that room from moving forward and that patient from moving forward. So, you know, everything's back and they're just waiting for discharge instructions, or everything's back and they just need that lax zone, and really they're just waiting for me. So the things that top out my priority list are the things that I'm holding up. So if I've already ordered everything and we're waiting for that CT, that room's in process, we're fine. I'm not worrying about that room. But that's the, it is tricky, and it's a skill that we don't talk much about. So that's something that I'm glad that someone sat me down during residency and said, okay, so here are your five patients. What are you doing with them?
Well, and assuming, like you kind of were mentioning in Pod D, it's frustrating when there's a lot of work you see that you can't do. The question I have is how, let's assume that we're building the structure of the department and the flow that you're the most expensive worker, and therefore we want you saturated most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Like,
there should always be somebody waiting on you.
Right.
Because if they're just waiting on the nurse, you either don't have enough patients to see, or there's something other, like it's just a slow day or something.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So let's assume you have a bunch of tasks that are all waiting on you. Do you have a category? I think I heard you kind of starting to say it, but like, how would you categorize or prioritize when you do have, and none of them are, this person's hypotensive.
Right, right.
Like, let's throw out the unstable patient.
Yeah, and I think the, like I said, so the patients who are in process are the ones that are on, those are sort of the ones that are at the back of the list. And then the front of the list for me are dispos. Okay. So it's
dispos.
Yeah, so you know, if I've got the decision between two rooms that are just waiting for me and one is a laceration, and I know that I've got to get to it, and the other one is a, you know, the discharge is ready and they're just waiting for me to go back and talk to the patient or do the paperwork, then that's going to be the priority, because that I can usually figure out that, then that moves that room forward. And as they're pulling in another patient, maybe I can do the LAC then. So just trying to maximize the efficiency as far as keeping not only the every room moving, but the whole department moving.
And So, and where, if you consider, we've talked a little bit about this and this, like, if let's say you get, you've got a couple people who, I'm going to just say two people waiting to go home. I think you've already said, and nobody's sick here. Two people waiting to go home. You want to get their stuff going.
Yep.
Nobody's waiting for procedures. Too. And they do too. And everybody does. Two people who've got stuff in progress that you just saw and you fired off stuff, treatments, labs, whatever, and two new people to see. And let's say you haven't done any documentation on the two who you've just fired stuff off. When do you, because my gut is sometimes you decide to go document, mm-hmm. sometimes you go decide to see those two people.
Yep. So that's a great scenario. I'll play this out. And I think, again, sort of moving the patients that can move out is sort of the first priority. So I think given the scenario you just gave me,
yeah.
the two discharges go first.
Yeah.
And then the decision for me comes down to, do I document or do I go see those two new ones?
Uh-huh, real quick? Right.
And I would say that in general, I will document if I'm on my game. If I'm on my game and I feel, it's funny because I think for some reason, and maybe this is just me, but documentation actually takes more mental energy from me than seeing patients. It's a lot, and maybe that's just because we all like seeing patients, we all like meeting new people and trying to help them, but the documentation piece, no one really likes. We do it because we have to. So I think if I'm on my efficiency game and I'm going to get out of there on time, I will do the documentation, then go see the next two patients. If I don't have that mental energy right then, because really, for me, it's harder to do the documentation than it is to see the two new patients. So, but if it's one of those days where I think I don't want to do that right now, yeah. then I'm going to go see the patients because that's what I enjoy more and that's what is more fulfilling.
Yeah. So one is sort of your brain telling you, I know this is the right thing. And the other is like, yeah, but I am not up for it. I'm going to go do what I like,
right.
which is talk to people.
that's exactly right.
One is I'm going to eat kale. And the other one's going to eat.
And I knew this was going to go to somewhere because that's exactly what I was thinking. I'm like, you can't always eat vegetables. Exactly. Sometimes you need a piece of cake.
Like, all right. So we just established that documentation is the base of the food pyramid. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. Yeah. And seeing patients is the cake.
Right. Okay. Well, that's interesting here. So, like, let me shift that scenario and say, you just did that. You just discharged those two people, and one of your other people, while you were doing those two, got their stuff back, and you got them all gone, and they all left. And you were documenting on the fourth, and they loaded your rooms up.
Yeah.
So now you've got five new patients to see.
That's always your reward, right?
For
being
right.
the most.
So now the cake. Somebody just served you more cake.
That's right. There's a great Simpsons scene where Homer is in
good.
Hell.
Simpsons had to be involved in this.
And he's being given all the donuts in the world, and the devil says, keeps giving him donuts, and Homer just keeps eating all the donuts in the world. And so I guess there is a point where, you know, too much cake is not going to be good for you. But Can you get that on the website? Can you get
we might have to have in the show notes.
I need Homer
and the devil
being force fed donuts happily.
probably can have that happen.
So I think at some point you do have to go tear off those five new patients and get them going.
I think the specific version of that I guess I'm just going to dive to is, do you chart scan in order versus try to go see people?
So sometimes, yes. My typical workflow for a new, let's say I've got several new patients, what I will typically do is just, you know, first make sure that none of them are sick.
Yeah.
That they don't need something acutely. But from there, there are some that you can tell. I mean, I'm surprised at how often I know exactly what they're going to need when I read
right.
the triage note. I'm also not at all surprised at how often I'm wrong when I do that. But for the most part, I think there are some that I go, oh, you know what? She is, she's 12 weeks pregnant. She's got belly pain and she's bleeding. She hasn't had an ultrasound. I know what I'm going to order in that patient. And I know with 99% certainty. So I can do that and sort of get that one going. So that in my book, even though I haven't seen them, is that plate is spinning. And then go see the ones that I need to do a little more diving.
Do you think there's a strategy of, this is what's hard for me, because I think when people look externally, they think like that somehow might get categorized as bad or a cut or a cheat, or you're not doing the history and physical in the order you learned as a third year student in medical school.
Yep.
The reality though is I do think what you just said is right, is once you're an expert player, you can predict the things you need often, because the nurses often collected chunks of that history.
Yep.
There are patterns that are just almost always there. There's synthesis of you see people roll by into the room that you're already doing your exam, that I think external people don't see those subtle things that happen. And sure. I feel like I worry about this, even this sort of podcast discussion, that people see how we think a little bit, but then don't quite understand it. And so that's kind of the example where I think there are scenarios where you don't really need to see the patient. You know, you're going to like, okay, you have a recent pregnancy test that's positive. I see that in the chart.
Yep.
And you have bleeding.
Or they did it in triage.
Bleeding. Ideally. I know that unless you refuse this care, you're going to get another blood draw.
Yep.
And you're going to probably get an ultrasound.
And I think most of the time, you know, this isn't something that I'm ordering. Because you're right, there are the scenario where you have five new patients, but most likely you have two or three new patients. So what I'm doing more often is putting that in, but I realize by the time I get in to see the second patient and back to that first patient, it's going to be 5 or 10 minutes. Realistically, nothing's going to happen in that 5 to 10 minutes. I've just gotten them in the queue for ultrasound a little faster.
Yeah, I think
faster.
You're right.
And so I wouldn't say that Still, I think you can. I think you can make very accurate predictions on what's going to need to happen.
And sometimes I think my guilt causes me, and this isn't, I don't think, a bad thing. My worry has been like, I don't want to be that patient who just has things starting done to me that I don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it doesn't have to be. Honestly, I think most patients are like, hey, I'm your doctor. I've read through the nurse. It looks like you're clearly needing this testing done. I've got it started, but I need to check in with one other person. I'll be back. But don't be surprised if they come in the room and start that stuff.
Because
they're starting stuff all the time, drawing blood, starting IVs that we didn't start them, you know.
Yep.
And so I think there's part of me that tries to get in there a little bit. And 1 in 10 times, I think that goes bad because that person's like, well, let me keep telling you about all this. And you're like, okay.
Right,
I'm going to stop it, or I am. And anyway,
yep.
So that's my perspective. But I think that's where I'm trying to learn how many people use that technique to really strong effect while still maintaining satisfaction of the patient and the staff and not over-testing and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Well, and I think there are, that again, you go with sort of the 80-20 rule, because most patients, one of their top priorities is going to be getting things figured out and then getting out sooner rather than later. So I think even if I come in after the blood is drawn and say, hey, so this is what we're going to, you know, we have the conversation, we say, this is what we're going to do. And then we kind of already got things going. Oh, ultrasound's ready to take you right now. I think that they're 80% of the time people are happy to have the ball rolling. And then there are people that say, wait, why are you drawing blood? Wait, no one's even seen me. Why are they taking me for my ankle x-ray? He hasn't even examined my ankle yet. So I think there are those. But I think for the most part, if you're able, that most people would rather get
things
rolling.
Even a nurse can do the ball rolling tee up. Like I could just say, can you let them know I ordered that stuff? And probably even half of our nurses, you don't even have to ask them to tell them that.
Right.
They just do that.
Yep.
But it's a little bit like, I don't want, in our current highly systematized world, ultrasound transport tech in a red shirt to just show up and say, we're taking you to ultrasound, and then the nurse doesn't know, the doctor didn't tell you.
Yep. And
And I don't know. I maybe that's a worry without substance. But
well, and back to your scenario, I think taking the sick, not sick out of it and just trying to efficiently manage five brand new patients, which does happen, I do choose the ones that I think I can be in and out fastest to see first.
Yeah.
And so it's not necessarily the most acute patients that I'm seeing. Again, if assuming they're sick, we're going to see them first. But if everyone looks sort of metastable, if I have someone with an ankle injury that I think I'm going to be able to go in there and look at their ankle and order the film and be done, I'm going to do that one first and sort of work my way up to the one that feels weak and dizzy and just doesn't feel good with a fever. And you kind of go, huh, that's going to be a little more of a, we're going to have to spend some more time on that one.
And this is hard for me to say, but again, I like to try to put out stuff that's real. Like what's really tricky is those same three patients and they all need language interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause then you're like, that would be quick, but I can't.
Yep. Well,
control that speed nearly as much.
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right. And
and whether the interpreter's available and whether, you know, like you sometimes have a whole other factor of like, how am I going to.
And I think one thing that, especially in those scenarios, is that I've gotten more comfortable with is having other people tee that up for me rather than being the one in the room dialing the interpreter or calling. I will step out of the room, ask, it could be a tech or a nurse or someone. Again, getting back to the...
That's a good tip.
Ideally, I'd rather be the
walk into the room, the interpreter is ready to talk.
Ready to go. And even if the interpreter has to wait a minute, or we pay for an extra minute of interpreter time on the phone, if I'm able to sort of extract myself, especially with some of the languages that we see every day that are not Spanish. It takes time to find the interpreter, and sometimes the first service that we try doesn't have that interpreter, and we have to. I mean, that can really take up 10-15 minutes of your time. That's true. if you're keeping all the other plates spinning during that time while one of the techs is waiting for the, you know, for the kissy interpreter, then
that's kind of how I try to, man, even in just my own mind, I think I forget about that. And I try to think about what's the work that only I can do.
Mm-hmm.
And almost always there's a note that only I can do waiting for me out there.
Right.
So even if you're just like, get that, I don't have anybody else new to see, all my things are spinning, all my plate, nobody's to discharge. I think my original tendency is, I just haven't learned this tip of what you just said, which is, whether it's a lack tray or something I could do, like there's always a note that I can't get the tech to do for me.
Right.
But I can get them to do that, even though I could probably get it done pretty quickly in most cases. I can probably dial the 9 and find the reality is that minute I could have probably signed a note or two.
And it's a tough line to walk because, you know, if a patient asks for water, I go out and get them water. I don't say, hey, I'm going to go find one of the techs to go get that patient a glass of water. They want a warm blanket. I can walk over to the warm blanket and I can grab a blanket. I can hand them a blanket rather than asking someone else to do it. So there are you know, things like that. But I think when it comes to time, more time intensive things that it really doesn't make as much sense for me to be doing, big picture wise, I try to delegate those.
Yeah, that's the hardest one is like, which I know I never have the time to do, but you're like, is the urgent, I need to go to the bathroom right now, and the elderly, probably ambulatory, but not sure.
Yep.
Like, I need to have somebody else find you because I can't spend the time figuring it out and get you safely to the bathroom and back.
Yeah, it's funny.
That's a 15-minute assessment.
I've never thought about this so specifically, but you're absolutely right. I think the things that I can walk out of the room, grab for a patient to make them more comfortable, food, blankets, whatever it is, get their family even, if it's something that I can walk out and do and be done, I think anyone can do that. I can do it. It doesn't have to be someone else. But yeah, you're right. I almost always, when it's the, I need to go to the bathroom, I almost always, I'll go out and I'll find someone and I'll say, they need to go right now. But I usually have other things I need to get done.
Because there's the ambulatory person, like, oh, let me show you where the bathroom is.
Right.
Oh, and here's the cup. Yeah. Like, that I can show you. But there's the, like, I bet you have been waiting for a go, and I'll bet you might have a risk of being incontinent in the bed, yet I'm still not going to be the person that gets you on the bed.
Yep,
I'd rather ask them to clean up the incontinence, which is going to be very unsatisfying to everybody.
Right.
But I can't be the person who
gets... No, it's a great line, and that is a hard line to walk. And I think some of the most efficient people are the people who understand how the things work, but also feel like they can do whatever it needs to get done. So I was cleaning a room the other day, and I was thinking, this probably isn't the best use of my time, but this is the way that we're going to kind of move this room forward. So for the department, it's what needs to happen. So I think the people who tend to be the most efficient are the ones that are willing to sort of do anything. But they have to realize when the time to do it is, and when the time is to say, "Oh,
yeah,
I really need to do this. Can you do that?"
Yeah, that calculus is really calculus in your head. Like, I am gonna change the sheet on this bed, and just get this room turned over so they can get somebody in there right now. Because I probably don't have many notes to do, or it's early in my shift, and there's six people I can get going versus. It's the last 20 minutes of my shift. I probably shouldn't change the bed because I could get one of my 12 notes a little farther down the road or something like that. And
it's not just the efficiency, right? I mean, that's the relationship with the people you're working with.
Right.
You know?
Right,
so it's if you're the type of provider who's willing to put on the sheet, that I think that gets you a lot of street cred with your
coworkers. I think that's true.
Your coworkers.
It's a very team-based care
scenario.
It's a lot easier to say, the woman that I was trying to find you on who was just incontinent in the bed, I need you to go take care of. Thank you very much. When they've watched you put a sheet on another bed.
Right, exactly. And I think that's because it is, it's not just about the efficiency. It's also about the relationships and the people. It's, like I said, they're going to drag me out of here kicking and screaming, but if you're going to be working with some people for 30 years, you want to be the person that gets the patient the water.
Yeah.
You want to be the patient, the person who gets the blanket rather than the one who asks someone else to do everything.
Yeah. Well, I have a few other questions. We got a little bit more time, if that's all right.
I'm free.
I could go a lot of directions, but I'm going to talk a little bit outside your shift now and say, is there any what I would call shift-related work that you purposely do outside of your shift? And I have examples, but the first one is, like, probably all of us have documented from home at some point, but are there other things like follow-ups that you've tried to do or like routinely or regularly or... I don't know how often it's tricky to decide to get a result that you know somebody else isn't going to follow up on, and you try to set a reminder to check this guy's MRI result.
So the fairly short answer is no.
Yeah.
I really try to compartmentalize my shift as much as I can. So when I'm done, I'm done. Because I think we're all, we all have a little bit of a tendency to want to make sure have control and be the one who's following up on all the tests. And I really need to, when I walk away from the shift, I need to be done. So I've definitely documented from home, but I think it's the exception rather than the rule. I even try to do my follow-ups on my next shift.
Okay.
And kind of send myself an in-basket message to check up on that patient sometimes I write down the interesting patients so I can follow up on them, but I try to not do it at home. I think the shift-related stuff that I do at home is when I get the chart sendbacks. Usually, if I'm at home doing email or something like that, I'll check in on the chart sendbacks and make sure that I don't have any chart deficiencies. But other than that, I want to work when I'm here, and I want to be home when I'm home.
I think we're all pretty much part of the reason we picked this specialty. It's interesting though, because I've heard a number of people talk about the follow-ups and the people you didn't plan to follow up on and how much people can learn. And I've been trying to figure out a high volume way, particularly with the EHR, that we like how could I build a way that you could just so quickly scan your last shift during the next shift?
Sure.
So that you could say, hey, I'm going to take, I know I could be seeing somebody, but like fitting into all of the other millions of things you're trying to do, like what would it be like to just kind of like be able to quickly see the end of the next office visit in one patient, the end of the discharge summary in the next, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yep.
And is that how many of those, or is there a particular group of patients, or because I do think there's a lot of unexpected learning and
Well, and to me that's also cakey goodness. You know, I love following up on the patients.
Yeah.
Either and good or bad, the ones where you follow up and you're like, I knew it. I knew that's what that rash was.
Well, or, there's like the rash, like there's obviously the, I went to the ICU and I spent half an hour in the ED or an hour.
Right.
But there's also like the, oh, I didn't realize they were going to do that tendon a day later, or that patient didn't show.
Right.
Now, I don't know what, I mean, I'm not going to probably call them and try to track them down, but.
Yeah.
You know, those are the kinds of things where you're like, I would have sworn that guy would have shown up.
Yeah. So it's funny because those are the things that, that, and like I said, I kind of keep them either in my in-basket or I will write them down on a card. You've seen my stack of cards that I probably have stacks of cards, or I probably have cards from 2 months ago. But to me, that's one of those mental breaks, kind of the mini mental breaks that you take during a shift, whether it's a, you know, a call to home to say hi to your significant other, or say goodnight to the kids on an evening shift, or it's sort of those little just 1 or 2 minute mental breaks. For me, following up on an interesting patient that I had last shift or a week ago, that's one of those mental breaks. It's kind of like the Facebook version on the shift, you know, just something to kind of, take your mind off your current shift and something interesting.
Sort of an unexpected exploring of something.
Yeah. So I don't have a great, I can't say that I have a great system, but I can say that that's a little, maybe that's more like candy. If seeing the patients is
so the cake. So we've got the cake, the candy, the veggies. Got it.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
We need a fiber. Well, that's kind of in the veggies. We talked about it really early, but I just wanted to mention, like, what are the other candy things? Like you talked about calling the, like, pre-bed check in with the family, or I think we've talked before about the importance of a meal.
Yeah, I eat no matter what.
Actual cake and candy. Yeah,
that's right. Maybe that's where
the candy is the candy.
Maybe that's where the protein comes in. Is that right? No, it's I can't, and it's not even necessarily about the food. I actually walk away most of the time if I'm at all able, and I take 15 or 20 minutes eating. Yeah. I'm usually with the resident.
Eating while looking at results or logged in.
No, like I usually
bringing a bar to your desk while trying to do a note.
Yeah, and in fact, before when we had you know, kind of the doc's work room and the nurse's break room right next to each other.
Yeah.
Now they're half a department away from each other. But back then, I would eat in the nurse's break room because people were taking a break. People were there to not work, which was a better setting
as
for me to
the
have
work room
where everyone is documenting.
Basically, you said it. The nurses have a break room. The doctors have a work room.
Yeah, it's true.
Not the doctors aren't allowed in it, but you basically are like, we should just break and not and work while eating.
Yep. So I think that I personally take 15, 20 minutes, if not more, sometimes, depending on the shift. But
depending on the potluck presence.
Right. Exactly right. So I tend to take some time off during a shift because I need that mental break. I can't be that focused for 8 straight hours. I just can't do it.
All right. Anything else?
I don't take anything very seriously, as you might have figured out. But
wait, what?
I mean, I have a lot of fun during the shift. You know, it's... it's usually at the resident's expense, sometimes at my own expense, but I mean, it's sort of I think just having those, I mean, we're here because of the people that we're working with, and whether it's having, spending an extra couple minutes talking to a 90-year-old woman and saying, so got any tips? got any light? I like doing that for, you know, if you if you could give one piece of advice to a, well, not so young whippersnapper anymore, but what would it be in your 90 years? You know, taking a couple extra minutes to talk to your patients or to talk to a coworker or find out, talk about the hockey game last night. We're in Minnesota. We can talk about the hockey game. But yeah. So it's, I think just having those moments and always being ready for those moments, I think that's what keeps you going throughout the shift. I think the really hard shifts are the ones where you, I mean, it's a chicken or the egg thing, but I feel like the least satisfying shifts are the ones where you don't have those interactions with patients, and you seem like the interactions aren't great, the systems don't work, you're not having fun with your coworkers. I feel like if you're having a good time with the people you're taking care of and the people that you're working with, you can put up with a lot.
That's funny. That makes me reflect, and I'm just going to say a little bit, like when you're working some of our shifts that can sort of stack you with people who have ongoing pain that's been bad enough that they're willing to wait multiple hours, but not bad enough to have a condition that makes them get back into a room quickly because they're, I don't want to say they're not sick, but you know what I mean? Like they don't have abnormal vital signs.
Right.
It's very difficult in those scenarios, in those patients often, to inject humor into that conversation. Whereas you can take somebody who's really sick in a lot of pain and inject humor. And I'm realizing now that you say that gives you a lot of resilience in your own like minutes taking care of that patient. Because if you can kind of joke with that patient, even just a little bit about like, oh, you're the ball and chain with the wife, or there's often some, he's my better half, I'm the worst half joke. Like even those little things go, I think, a long way for me, probably more than I realize.
Yeah.
It just compared to the relentless, like everybody, like you're doing the wrong thing, like pain or headache, or you don't know what's wrong with me.
Yeah.
Like trying to figure out how to joke with those patients and I'd love to figure out how to teach that. Like, how and when do you inject humor into your sick patient?
You're right. Cause I think it's the difference between talking to a patient and talking to another person. So I think
you're right. Because I think you all of a sudden humanize them.
Exactly. It's more human, and it's more, you know, I think of it, you can have a separate podcast on casual care, but you know, when your buddy comes over and says, hey, can you look at this? Or can you look at my daughter's ear or whatever it is? That interaction is similar, but it's different, right? Because it's more informal, and you're doing the same medical things, but you're also talking about what's going on this weekend or whatever it is. And I think that is so enjoyable. I mean, I love taking care of the kids in our neighborhood. I think that's, you know, that really is one of the most fun things I get to do with with the position. And the more my shift can be like that, where, and I think we're all pretty good about kind of establishing a relationship in seconds, you know, with the introduction and the first couple minutes. I think we're all pretty good about that. So the more you can see that, I mean, the more we can develop those relationships quickly, and then all of a sudden we're taken care of almost like a brand new friend rather than just kind of trying to move the meat and get through. And I think that, you know, from we're talking more about resiliency. That's not always the most efficient thing to do, but I think a lot of times it is, because I think you get to the bottom of the problem faster, the better that relationship is. So I think sometimes you even wind up learning what the issue is faster by having
what's most important today.
Yeah, exactly. And it's more fulfilling having that type of interaction, that sort of relationship.
Sometimes
it can be more efficient.
Hard, like, I know you came here for X, but I need to tell you why.
Right.
Discussions once you've built that. Like, look, if you go into that, it's hard to transition right into the, look, I need to tell you something you don't want to hear.
Yeah.
If you've started by sort of establishing yourself as I respect you and I'm a straight shooter, it's a lot easier to just go, like, you don't want to hear that one of the big aspects of this is smoking, or one of, you know, that you probably wouldn't be here if if the alcohol that you had consumed had been less, you know what I mean? Like that kind of tough transition from, yeah, I know my ankle's broken, but really the bigger problem is X.
And, and getting back to sort of the bigger discussion, I feel like the more you feel like you're caught up and the more you feel like you've got an extra minute or two to talk to that patient, the easier that is and the more rewarding it is. And the flip side is the more you feel like I've got five more people to see and I haven't done my 15 notes, the more irritating that conversation is.
Yeah, that's a good perspective.
To have it. So the, you know,
it's a little bit of, I keep coming back to this like slow down to speed up mantra. Yeah. It's like slow down and listen, build that rapport. You may, maybe the world's falling apart and either, you know, you're going to be on for a while, but often you end up making like more simple choices. I think you order fewer tests because you realize you got to the bottom of it, or this was just, I need a work note and now I can document less and I can, you know what I mean?
Like, right.
So I,
and it's just, it's hard to get to that. It's hard to get that if you really feel like you're behind all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you feel like you don't have the time and you can't, you don't have time for this. You've already decided what you're going to do. And
well, and I think that's kind of why when I opened, I asked about feeling drained when you leave or feeling fulfilled. Cause I feel like there's this budget we all start with of drained to fulfillment visual analog scale. And it's somewhere, sometimes it can be both. Like you can have a really tired shift where you did a lot of amazing things, but a lot of times it's, like as the shift goes on, you start to get into the, I'm so far behind. I've got so many things. I don't have time to talk to this person. I don't have time to get the interpreter this time.
I don't have time to eat. I don't have time to have that, to find out how my coworker's kids' soccer tournament went this weekend. And
I think it's one thing if you're hitting that at hour 7, at least on an 8-hour shift. It's another thing if you're hitting that at hour 3.
Right. Yeah.
And your whole rest of your shift is just this, or worse, you made some choice about your vacation and you're underslept when you show up at hour 0 and you're just like, "Oh, I didn't even want to come in today.
I'm
really mad and angry," or but I'm still going to pound out the shift.
Right, right. But I think that there's it feels like magic in the residents, no matter how much we try to convince them, you know, keeping up with your documentation during a shift will actually make you more efficient. And it's totally counterintuitive, right? The more time you spend on your charts, the more patients you'll be able to see. And I think a lot of it is this mental energy. It's this feeling like I don't have time to spend this extra couple minutes learning about what this patient did, because you go, wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah,
I'm going to take 2 minutes and ask them about their job or whatever it is, because that's so interesting and rewarding, and you get to escape the grind for a couple minutes, and feeling like you have those couple minutes, I think is can really make the difference in a shift.
Yeah. Well, I need to wrap us up. Let's talk about a few closing questions. So do you see any, like if you looked at the colleagues that maybe have come after you or maybe even before, do you think there's anybody, like do you see pitfalls that people stumble into that you'd be like, man, I wish I could just grab them and not have that happen? Like, or that you would tell them almost mentorship style, like we just talked about some of them, like eat, like I see you trying to get one more patient by not eating or something, other things like that, that you would.
Yeah. I think there are, the big ones are keeping, I mean, we need to convince people that documentation is part of their job and they need to do that during their shift, that not all of it after their shift. And I think that, again, it seems like magic, but the people who are able to do it find that they're more efficient once they make that change. So I think that's the biggest pitfall, because I can't, again, it's not just the hour or two after the shift that you're here. It's the whole shift feeling behind. And back to your fulfillment versus drained, it's that, it's not the hour or two after the shift that would would get to me long term. I think it's the feeling behind for the whole 8 hour shift that I see people starting down that path, but I think we're able to pull them out of that pretty quickly. But oh yeah, eat the cake. Eat the cake, see your patients, eat the candy,
and have fun. When you can, like, have fun.
It is just
get in there, like, what test do I have to order? Okay, good, we got that going. No, go.
Yeah, and it really is funny. The older I get, the more enjoyment I have with the patients, which is kind of weird because I feel like we all go into the profession because we want to help people and all those sort of seemingly trite reasons, but we like people, we like helping them, and then we get that sort of beaten out of us, and we need to move, we need to get things going, we need to make the diagnosis, and it's kind of fun. I feel like once you get past some of that, then you go, oh, I really like this again. This is fun. This is kind of why I went into it, getting to know patients and spend time with them.
Right.
And
it gives you a new perspective on what you want to do.
Yeah, you get to teach them. You get to make them feel better. It's fantastic.
Do you, so my main wrap-up question is really this sort of litmus test of, you have children. If they were like, I want to be an emergency physician or a physician, would you be like, sounds great, or I want to steer you away?
100%. Oh, no doubt about it. I think
question.
Right. I know. not only would I do it with my kids, I do it with our rotating residents. They're the first year resident and something else. I think, hey, you know, you seem to be having fun with this. Are you sure you want to do OB? I guess we have actually pulled a couple people away, but I mean, I think it's fantastic. I think there are, you know, the downsides are the downsides. No one likes working nights and weekends and holidays and that sort of thing, but we've got one of the greatest gigs on the face of the earth. I mean, we walk around, we get to talk to people, we get to help them with whatever they're dealing with that day. Yeah. We get to make them feel better. We get to train other doctors and there to do the same.
Yeah.
I mean, that it there's not a much better gig, and we're not on call. We know when we're going to work. We can have a life outside of this. I mean, for so many reasons, both professionally and then personally, sort of outside the profession. Yes, 100%. I would tell my kids to do it, and I would tell anyone else who will listen to do it.
Yeah, well, that's cool. Is there anybody else that you think I should have a conversation with that you'd throw under the bus?
this is the bucket challenge.
It's a little bit of the bucket challenge.
This is I now challenge.
How does he do it? Because that's really what started me in this. Was like, how does, like, with you? How do you stay? You're relentlessly positive. You're very much trying to build that energy of I'm having fun. I'm here to build people up and not suck the life out of everybody.
Right.
And so there's a little bit of like trying to undercover some of that because none of that is in. Up to date.
Well, right. Well, I'll tell you, I have no problem.
They don't have to work here. They can work anywhere.
I'm happy to throw Sam Stealth under the bus. And I'll tell you why.
And that's not sarcastic. No,
no, no. And might even be literal. What Sam is good at, not only does he have a good attitude about all this, I think he's very articulate about the factors that go into it. And I watch him give resident feedback, and he can articulate things that I can sense and I can feel, but I'm not nearly as good at putting them into words and summing it up as he is. So I think he would be, and he's also just a unique guy, but I think he would be able to articulate the things that he does that can make a difference in his job.
Okay, that's cool. I think I'm trying to build up a list of, I mean, I think any of us have something to give, and I'm kind of just trying to learn ways to start the conversation with other people as well. So I think that's something, because I don't get to work with him a lot. I haven't observed a lot of that, but
yeah.
I know how well Sam helps people build decision trees about what they plan to do.
Yep.
And that's something I've taken away. I was like, wow, I think even other people almost label it as Sam's method, even though it's pretty generic of making choices and you're going to do X and Y. And then if X is positive, I'm going to do Y or Z. And
yep. And he really is good at evaluating the residents from kind of what they're doing well and what they're not doing well and articulating it and, cool. and giving them that feedback. So I think that's, I think he would do the same for how he gets through a shift and has a good time doing it.
Yeah. And I bet we'd have fun.
Yeah, exactly.
I think people will like to listen to Sam.
And nobody more so than Sam.
Well put. He can just play it back to him in the car.
That's right. That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah, that's true. All right. Well, thanks for spending an hour or more with me. And I have actually, we didn't even get to half my questions on my list.
Well,
so
maybe we'll have,
we might have to have another time, but I won't, torture you anymore. So
all right,
thanks a lot.
Good. Well, thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to this episode of Positively Deviant Emergency Medicine. Please consider subscribing to the podcast wherever you find your podcasts, or you can listen on the web at positivelydeviant.audio. There you can also leave a comment, tell your colleagues, or tweet me up. It helps spread the word. You can also leave your feedback to make them better, or you can give me your guest suggestions. And here's a standard disclaimer. The thoughts and views expressed in this podcast are those of the individuals alone. No one you heard here represents the organizations where they work. Now that you've heard that, let's shut it down. Until next time, thanks again for listening.